Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 104, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Daisy, I love you.
Please don't. You want too much. I love you now, isn't that enough? I can't help what's past. I did love him once, but I loved you too.
Love me too. There are things between Daisy and me that you'll never know. Things that neither one of us can ever forget. Darling, I'm going to take better care of you from now on, too.
You don't seem to understand. You're not going to take care of her anymore.
I'm not? Why is that?
Daisy's leaving you.
I am, though.
Hello, and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that is brought to you by the Future Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. As always, I'm Tom Paneris, and with me, standing at the edge of the dock, looking out at the green light, even though I think we're more close to being Nick and Jordan than any of the other three, is Stella. How are you?
I'm well. I think we should rename this The Gay Gatsby. Am I right? Yuck, yuck. Yes, I'm doing okay.
Spit water out of my monitor.
I think the goal of this show has become, how can I talk about periods every episode and see if there's any sort of homoerotic or queer behavior in, and honestly, it's not a stretch.
It's Long Island. It's not Fire Island, though.
Ooh. So. Yes, but close. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Because we're both on quasi summer breaks. We were talking before we went on the air here that we have some summer curriculum work we're doing in some capacity. I'm also trying to get some writing done and not go completely stir crazy. How have you been?
Yeah, I've been okay. I took Monday off. Originally, I was going to go into school to do some work on Monday, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to take Monday off. So I've just been reading. Frankly, I was reading like three books at a time. I had The Great Gatsby going. I've been reading Hera by Jennifer Saint. And then I'm reading like an unhinged romance novel. At first it was Lights Out. I'm just like going through the ones that are, you know, really popular. And now I'm reading Kiss of the Basilisk. But listen, I'm just, because I have this sick, curiosity to find out what it's actually about. And I couldn't find, you know, a synopsis video online. Mm. So I'm speed reading them. Do I recommend them? No, I do not. So I'm reading them so you all don't have to. But it's been nice to like vegetate, you know, and not feel guilty about vegetating. Because during the school year, I always feel guilty. Even on weekends, if I'm not productive, I feel really guilty about it.
Yeah.
But now it's like, I don't actually have any other thing that I, you know, have to do. With the exception of podcasting, that's always looming over me. But but otherwise, yeah, it's nice to relax and recover from the year.
Yeah. I kind of feel the same way, although, you know, I relate to the productivity guilt, so to speak. No, I've been reading some stuff too. I had read a short story by an author with my freshman. I was like, she has a novel, and I was like, oh, let me read the novel. It was uneven. I was like, yeah. And then I'm currently reading a short story collection called like the Dictionary of Failed Romances, which is basically like an every like the story. There are 26 stories. There's each starts with a different letter of the alphabet, and they're almost like flash fiction, or a little bit longer. It's actually kind of an interesting little thing. And short story collections are great because you can just kind of put one down here and there, and pick it up. I did grab The Great Alone by Kristen Hannah off of my shelf other day, and I haven't started it yet. And then, but it's funny because on Libby, I was going through Libby just looking for like what's interesting, you know, what can I check out or at least put in like start a want to read list. And I was looking for like mystery stuff, you know, like not like detective novels per se, more like normal people getting wrapped up in some sort of mystery thing. And then I did start like and then I realized that I had started to fall down the rabbit hole of recommended smut, and I'm like, oh geez, Stella. So I have a few. I'm like, I'm kind of curious about a couple here and there. I can't tell you what they are off the top of my head, but I may read a couple because every once in a while they're just like,
I can't wait to hear what they are and what you think of them.
Because my other reading, like comics, are just not lately. I've been reading a few here and there, but like they're not all, I don't know, I'm like, I need a break from it or something. So every once in a while I pull something up on like DC Infinite or read Jeff the Land Shark over on Marvel, but I love Jeff the Land Shark.
Jeff, what sort of adventures does he get into? Is he unhinged?
No, he's just very cute and mischievous and stuff.
Okay,
so it's actually very, very cute comic. It takes like maybe 30 seconds to read one and stuff like that. So, but no, but I was trying to find stuff that's a little bit different anyway. But we had this, which is compared to our last few books, is actually slightly a little bit more slim and such. We're going to do our usual with it. So I guess my first question is, what is your history with The Great Gatsby, even though I'm pretty sure I know where it begins?
It's quite shocking that I haven't read this for probably 2 decades. Mm-hmm. I would have been a junior in high school, and it would have been AP English, and this was on the curriculum along with The Crucible, which is fine, and The Awakening, which is not fine. And trying to think if there was anything else. I mean, those are the ones that I definitely recall. So yeah, that junior year, AP English. It's interesting that I read this book this time in 2 days,
mm-hmm.
and I could have read it in 1 day. And when you're a teenager, and part of it is because you have all these other classes you're doing work for, but the thought of doing that is sort of inconceivable. But I thought that was amusing. And it came, I knew the majority of the story beats. I would not have caught, I don't think, any of the queerness as I see it. And I don't recall the racism or like Aryan race, kind of like we're the superior. Oh, in that scene,
yeah, the mastery stuff.
Yeah,
it was
super, which, yeah, came up a couple times. I mean, I definitely remember the socioeconomic issues or judgments between, or prejudice. So it was nice to revisit being older and being able to, I think, recall things. And then also, I think, being wiser and more intelligent. And more well-read, that I think the language went better for me than it probably did in junior year.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen the Robert Redford version, but I did at my previous establishment. There was an auction every year, and one of the items that I would put in for the auction is like, spend the day with me. And it was usually only for, or was only for female students, just so there was no impropriety there. And, you know, I'd give options like, hey, you know, could do dinner or a movie, you could go to a theme park, you know, roller coasters, things like that. And 1 year I won, or 1 year the people who won, which were 2 juniors, I think. that I had taught Latin to, they wanted to go see the new Great Gatsby film by Baz Luhrmann.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out later that the English teacher who was teaching them was a bit upset because they had not reached the end. And she, I guess, had told her students not to see this film until after, because it would spoil, of course, what happened. So I recall seeing that. So I feel like that's the last time I had seen the Great, or had anything to do with the Great Gatsby. It, which is interesting because now if I think about the people who are in that cast, it sort of blows my mind as to where they are now, because definitely I knew Leo and Tobey Maguire, but now I'm like such a fan of Carey Mulligan, and she was Daisy, and then Elizabeth
Debicki.
Yeah, like she's, you know, she's Princess Diana in The Crown. So it's just interesting when I went back, I'm like, oh my gosh, all these people. So that is my history with The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, I also first read it in the 11th grade. I think like most people were assigned this in high school, English and stuff. It's a pretty standard book. Yeah, I, like you, I didn't get that whole scene with the Tom Buchanan spouting off about the master race and all that. It was very strange.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, but then again, I don't remember how I reacted to this when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I didn't hate it. I knew that. I may have liked it, but it might have just kind of fallen by the wayside in a year where we read like 5 or 6 different things. Cause I remember, what do we read? Death of a Salesman, Macbeth, Huck Finn, A Separate Piece, The Catcher in the Rye. Did we read Lord of the Flies that year, or is that 12? Anyway, but we would read like 5 or 6 novels like year. And so this kind of, it was grouped into all of them. And I don't know if it's just, it didn't really stand out. And so I've seen both of those movies in bits and pieces. I've actually never seen either the Redford movie or the DiCaprio movie in full. I've read it now. This is like my fourth time, because I did teach it for 2 years. Like, I've only taught 11th grade for 2 years. It was about almost 20 years ago. Actually, I just finished my 20th year of teaching. So it would have been like, 19, my second and third year I taught 11th grade, and then went over to the, you know, doing 10th, and I haven't taught 11th grade since. But The Great Gatsby was one of the books that we taught. So I did read it then, obviously. And then when I was just a number of years ago, when I was actually starting the project that kind of gave me the idea, or gave us the idea for this, which is where I was like reading through the books that I read in high school and junior high, is just kind of a project, like revisiting them. And this was one of the ones on the list. And I read this, and then I just read this for, this episode as well. You're right about the maturity aspect of it. It's like this, and I think Ethan Frome is another example of like, when you reread that book after having been a teenager and reading it, you get a different perspective, or you get more of it, and it's a little easier, and you start to get some of the commentary and things, and really applying them to current day. We'll get into that as well. I will get into the background of the author. I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald, it's like its own, he's got like his own biography episode, you know, like that. That's Fitzgerald, as well as his relationship with his wife Zelda, and so a lot of ink has been spilled. I would not be able to cover all of it in the time that we have, so I'm going to talk about him. I'm also going to talk about the creation of the novel itself. I mean, this thing is kind of like, The Stuff of Legend is not the best way to put it, but it is one of those books that gets slotted into the spot of the possible great American novel. So that's why it's kind of got some legendary things behind it, or at least, you learn about who this guy was and such. So, set of the prosperous... Oh, my resource for this was Wikipedia, by the way. Set of the prosperous Long Island of 1922... The Great Gatsby provides a critical social history of Prohibition-era America during the Jazz Age, which was known for its jazz music, economic prosperity, flapper culture, libertine mores, rebellious youth, and ubiquitous speakeasies. And anybody who has read this in high school, a lot of you, I didn't, but a lot of you had to attend Gatsby parties in your English class. Anyway, Fitzgerald conveys the hedonism of the Jazz Age society by following a down-to-earth narrator as a spectator of the flashiest and most raucous era in American history at the time. In Fitzgerald's eyes, the era represented a morally permissive time when Americans of all ages became disillusioned with prevailing social norms and obsessed with pleasure-seeking. The Great Gatsby reflects various events in Fitzgerald's youth. He was a young Midwesterner from Minnesota. Like the novel's narrator who went to Yale, he was educated in an Ivy League school, but it was Princeton. And that was there that the 18-year-old Fitzgerald met Ginevra King, a 16-year-old socialite with whom he fell deeply in love. Although she was madly in love with him, her upper-class family opened to scourge the courtship of their daughter because of his lower-class status. And her father purportedly told him that, quote, poor boys shouldn't think of marrying rich girls. Rejected by Ginevra's family as a suitor because of his lack of financial prospects, suicidal Fitzgerald enlisted in the United States Army amid World War I, was commissioned as a second lieutenant. While awaiting deployment to the Western Front, where he hoped to die in combat, he was stationed at Camp Sheridan in Montgomery, Alabama, where he met Zelda Sayre, a vivacious 17-year-old Southern belle. After learning that Ginevra had married wealthy Chicago businessman William Bill Mitchell, Fitzgerald asked Zelda to marry him. Zelda agreed but postponed their marriage until he became financially successful. Fitzgerald is thus similar to Jake Gatsby in that he became engaged while a military officer stationed far from home and then sought immense wealth in order to provide for the lifestyle which his fiancée had become accustomed. Fitzgerald's breakthrough novel was This Side of Paradise in 1920. He also had a number of short stories that were successful, many of which centered around the Jazz Age. It's a term that he helped popularize. He married Zelda, relocated to Long Island, and the two of them were kind of a celebrity writer couple. They enjoyed the exclusive Long Island milieu, but Fitzgerald quietly disapproved of the extravagant parties, and the wealthy persons he encountered often disappointed him. While striving to emulate the rich, he found their privileged lifestyle to be morally disquieting. This eventually led to a move into Europe. That's where he wrote Gatsby, and the novel had its mediocre sales when it took out. It actually took decades to become the classic that we now know it is. While in Europe, Fitzgerald became close friends with Ernest Hemingway, and Zelda's mental health began to deteriorate. There's a lot of stories of her lashing out at him and, like, ridiculing him in front of people, etc. They returned from Europe in 26. They moved to Hollywood in 27. They were there for about 2 months. Then they moved to Delaware. She was eventually diagnosed around 1930 with, they said, schizophrenia. And I guess, I mean, that's the diagnosis, at least that Wikipedia says. And she was institutionalized at various points. One of them, she was at the hospital, at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. And he rented the LaPay Estate in Towson, Maryland. So... his final novel was 1934's Tender is the Night, which is not well received. It sold poorly. It's since been reevaluated. It is considered not up there with Gatsby, but is considered a good work of literature. I personally have never read it. The cost of Zelda's psychiatric treatment nearly bankrupted him, and he was more or less washed up by the middle of the 30s. He tried to get another go at Hollywood. He tried writing more short stories. That really failed. He was also an alcoholic, and his addiction was one of the other reasons for the decline of his career, money, and health. He died of a heart attack in 1940, and Zelda died in 1948. Now, like I said, Gatsby was written. It came out. It did not do greatly. I'll talk about adaptations in a moment, but I do want to talk briefly about the book's cover. Because the artwork for the first edition of The Great Gatsby is a painting known as Celestial Eyes. And the cover of this book has really rarely changed over the years because it is one of the most celebrated covers in American literature. It's like cover to Sgt. Pepper's or something. Like, you know, like people know this cover. And it represents a unique instance in literary history in which a novel's commissioned artwork directly influenced the composition of the text. It's rendered in an Art Deco visual style. The artwork depicts the disembodied face of a Jazz Age flapper with celestial eyes and rouged mouth over a dark blue skyline. A little-known Barcelonan painter named Francis Cugat was commissioned by an unknown individual in Scribner's art department to illustrate the cover while Fitzgerald was composing the novel. Although Fitzgerald likely never saw the final painting prior to the novel's publication, the preparatory drafts influenced his writing. Upon viewing Cugat's drafts before before sailing to France in April and May of 1924, Fitzgerald was so enamored that he later told editor Max Perkins that he incorporated the imagery into the novel. So a lot of people then analyzed these interrelations between the novel and the text. One popular interpretation that the celestial eyes are reminiscent of those of optometrist T.J. Eckelberg depicted on a faded commercial billboard near George Wilson's auto repair shop. I do know that that gets like prominent play in the Redford movie because I remember seeing clips where they do focus on that billboard and it's they do their best to make it look as genuine as possible. Hemingway supported this interpretation, claimed Fitzgerald had told him the cover referred to a billboard in the Valley of the Ashes. Although this passage has some resemblance to the imagery, a closer explanation can be found in Fitzgerald's explicit description as Daisy Buchanan, as the girl with whose disembodied face floated along the dark cornices and blinding signs. We did mention, of course, two movie adaptations. There has been a play. It was directed by George Cukor and starred James Rennie as Gatsby and Florence Eldridge's Daisy. It opened on Broadway on February 2nd, 1926. It was well received by critics and the public. The run was extended past the originally scheduled closing date and finally ending on May 22nd after 112 performances. It's been adapted for opera and ballet. The first film version of the novel appeared in 1926. Following the 1926 film was 1949's The Great Gatsby, starring Alan Ladd, Betty Field, and MacDonald Carey. In 1974, you have The Great Gatsby, which was directed by Jack Clayton and starred Robert Redford as Gatsby, Mia Farrow as Daisy, and Sam Waterston as Nick Carraway. And as we both mentioned, Baz Luhrmann directed The Gatsby in 2013 with Leonardo DiCaprio as Gatsby, Carey Mulligan as Daisy, Tobey Maguire as Nick, and Elizabeth Debicki as Jordan. So that is just kind of a quick rundown of Fitzgerald and the novel itself. I'm just going to get into the plot synopsis here. In spring 1922, Nick Carraway, a Yale alumnus from the Midwest and a World War I veteran, journeys to New York City to obtain employment as a bond salesman. He rents a bungalow in the Long Island village of West Egg, next to a luxurious estate inhabited by Jay Gatsby, an enigmatic multimillionaire who hosts dazzling soirees, yet does not partake in them. One evening, Nick dines with a distant cousin, Daisy Buchanan, in the old money town of East Egg. Daisy is married to Tom Buchanan, formerly a Yale football star whom Nick knew during his college days. The couple has recently relocated from Chicago to a mansion directly across the bay from Gatsby's estate. There, Nick encounters Jordan Baker, an insolent flapper and golf champion who is a childhood friend of Daisy's. Jordan confides to Nick that Tom keeps a mistress who brazenly telephones him at the home and lives in the, quote, Valley of Ashes, a sprawling refuse dump. This, by the way, is modern-day Flushing, Queens, which is where the current location of LaGuardia Airport, City Field, and the old New York World's Fair site, as well as the Arthur Ashe Tennis Center. So that evening, Nick sees Gatsby standing alone on his lawn, staring at a green light across the bay. Days later, Nick reluctantly accompanies a drunken and agitated Tom to New York City by train. En route, they stop at the garage inhabited by George Wilson and his wife, Myrtle, who is also Tom's mistress. Myrtle joins them. The trio proceeds to a small New York apartment that Tom has rented for trysts, and guests arrive. A party ensues, and this ends with Tom slapping Myrtle and breaking her nose after she mentions Daisy. One morning, Nick receives a formal invitation to a party at Gatsby's mansion. Once there, Nick is embarrassed that he recognizes no one and begins drinking heavily until he encounters Jordan. While chatting with her, he is approached by a man who introduces himself as Jay Gatsby and insists that both he and Nick served in the 3rd Infantry Division during the war. Gatsby attempts to ingratiate himself with Nick, and when Nick leaves the party, notices Gatsby watching him. In late July, Nick and Gatsby have lunch at a speakeasy. Gatsby tries impressing Nick with tales of war heroism and his Oxford days. Afterward, Nick meets Jordan again at the Plaza Hotel. Jordan reveals that Gatsby and Daisy met around 1917 when Gatsby was an officer in the American Expeditionary Forces. They fell in love, but when Gatsby was deployed overseas, Daisy reluctantly married Tom. Gatsby hopes that his newfound wealth and dazzling parties will make Daisy reconsider. He uses Nick to stage a reunion with Daisy, and the two embark upon an affair. In September, Tom discovers the affair when Daisy carelessly addresses Gatsby with unabashed intimacy in front of him. Later, at a Plaza Hotel suite, Gatsby and Tom argue about the affair. Gatsby insists Daisy declare that she never loved Tom. Daisy claims she loves Tom and Gatsby, upsetting both. Tom reveals Gatsby is a swindler whose money comes from bootlegging alcohol. Upon hearing this, Daisy chooses to stay with Tom. Tom scornfully tells Gatsby to drive her home, knowing that Daisy will never leave him. While returning to East Egg, Gatsby and Daisy drive by Wilson's garage, and their car strikes Myrtle, killing her instantly. Later, Gatsby reveals to Nick that Daisy was driving the car, but he intends to take the blame for the accident to protect her. Nick urges Gatsby to flee to avoid prosecution, but he refuses. After Tom tells George that Gatsby owns the car that struck Myrtle, a distraught George assumes the owner of the vehicle must be Myrtle's lover. George fatally shoots Gatsby in his mansion swimming pool and then kills himself. Several days after Gatsby's murder, his father, Henry Gatz, arrives for the sparsely attended funeral. After Gatsby's death, Nick comes to hate New York and decides that Gatsby, Daisy, Tom, and he were all Midwesterners unsuited to Eastern life. Nick encounters Tom and initially refuses to shake his hand. Tom admits he was the one who told George that Gatsby owned the vehicle that killed Myrtle. Before returning to the Midwest, Nick returns to Gatsby's mansion and stares across the bay at the green light emanating from the end of Daisy's dock. That is a summary of The Great Gatsby. Stella, what'd you think?
Yes. You know, if you think about it, not a lot happens. I mean, obviously you had a synopsis, but, you know, you could have done it in a couple sentences about what goes on. Because it really does. It's amazing sometimes when you think about some of these novels that, like, wow, what actually happened in this novel? I did. Yes, I will say that I like it. I think that it deserves its place in the, I don't know, the Mount Washington. No, what's that called? The Rushmore. Mount Rushmore of, yeah, of literature, that, you know, it probably has a place up there. And it was nice to revisit. There were a couple times I had to pause just because of the writing. I had to reread it a couple times, but I always appreciate some difficult things as long as the author's not being pretentious. So I will say yes.
Yeah, I did too. You know, what's interesting is that I read this about a chapter a day. Oh. I was reading it at lunch and I didn't intend to do that. It's just that I would like reach the end of the chapter and then I looked up the clock and there was like maybe 5-6 minutes left and I'm like, well, I'm not going to start another chapter. And I think by around the time I hit the middle of like chapter 3, I'm like, I think I'm going to do this like a chapter a day. It's a really leisurely written novel. Mm-hmm. In a sense, like, you're right. There's some action scenes, but there's some tension, but it's meant to, it kind of feels like summer in that sense. It's just, it's written in a very kind of easy sort of way where Nick's kind of floating through this world. And I really came to appreciate that this time around, because like one of the complaints I had like way, way back in the day, I remember the first, when I read it like for the second or third time, was that it starts really slow. And this time around, and maybe it's because I was so familiar with it, it was like my fourth time reading the book, right? It didn't feel as slow starting out, because you don't really meet Gatsby until like chapter 4, I think. It's chapter 3 or 4. But that's kind of cool because it builds up like what this guy is. There's a little bit of mystery about him. And you find out at the end of the novel that, like, you know, he's this guy named Jay Gatz who essentially created this persona of Gatsby to impress, you know, to for various reasons. One of them is to get this girl Daisy, and it's and everything is kind of fabricated from whole cloth. And yeah, I was just kind of really into it in a way that I hadn't expected, and I really did enjoy this again. So, all right. So we were both talking about how it, you know, it has this reputation. It is kind of part of the American canon at this point, right? But as I mentioned in the background, it was not a success when it was first published. It actually sold fewer than 24,000 copies while Fitzgerald was still alive. And a number of the questions that we have, I grabbed from a Random House book club set of questions for The Great Gatsby. So, and then I have some of my own. Around the time of World War II, it got in the hands of a lot of troops. The army just kind of distributed copies as they did with a bunch of books and things like that to have on the front. And it started to get way more popular. By now, it is a high school English standard. It is in there as one of the more popular or well-regarded American novels of the 20th century, if not all time. Why do you think it finally struck a chord? How do you think the novel transcended this underwhelming reputation? And why is it assigned in high school?
Did you say it's World War II?
Yeah, the Second World War.
Yeah, I think they can really relate to Jay as he was Gats before he was Gatsby, I think. And that was something that the soldiers, I think, would be searching for post-World War II. And even in the trenches, hopefully just trying to get out of there and having some sort of life beyond that, and what will their life look like. And we know, of course, the baby boomers and everything. So that's certainly, I think, like a physical representation of looking for the great American dream. Mm-hmm. So I think they start to relate to him in that way. I think also it's a bygone era. I don't know. Maybe that's not like the right term necessarily, but I think once the 20s passed, they became something super special. Like, I love the 20s. I love flappers. I love the thought of flappers doing the Charleston on a biplane. Mm-hmm. So I think just like this historical like capsule all in a novel is something that people start to appreciate. And yeah, it's not super heavy and you can get lost in any of the characters. I think that the characters are so diverse that probably inevitably you're going to find yourself thinking that you are one of them. I mean, hopefully you're not Tom, but fingers crossed you're not Tom. And then as for why it's on the American or why it's in high school, I think it's just a great representation of American literature. I think we have standouts. I mean, this one, maybe it's the 200th episode that we do or 150, I don't know, but you know, I think there are standouts of novels throughout the world and in different parts of the world that even those people, I think, would all say like, yes, this will always be kind of on the Mount Rushmore of novels for us, you know, for Russia or for England or something like that. And I think that it happens to be for America. I think because it is something known as the American dream, which might not have been called that at the time, but later had been known that. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't know.
Okay.
I honestly don't know where the origin of the phrase is.
Okay. And yeah, I think again, it's if in your curriculum, you're trying to give different, so I'm trying to think when the Awakening was, because I feel like wasn't that around the same time, or is that in the 50s? But the hope is that you're spanning across many years and you're trying to give novels or pull novels from different time periods. So if you're doing Huck Finn, then you have, you know, 19th century and then the 20th with this one. And then you're kind of moving up and doing things like that. So I feel like that's potentially one of the reasons. And I think that, we did the Scarlet Letter in junior year as well. That was the one we did. I think this one's not as tough as other novels can be, too. I think there's a certain readability to it that others might not have. Like I said, I think there are some complex sentence structures and certainly some words. Like I had to look up a couple words that I had not seen or recalled. So all of that, I think, maybe is why it fits well in a school curriculum.
All right. Yeah. The Awakening, by the way, Kate Chopin, right? Mm-hmm. 1899.
Oh, okay. So that's pretty close to Huck Finn then.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you on like everything you said. And I think that American dream aspect of it, which tends to be a central theme of high school English in the 11th grade, when you're tested with a lot of people study American lit in the 11th grade. And that does tend to be one of the overarching themes of those courses, because if you like, we had read, Death of a Salesman, for instance, which has heavy, heavy American dream. Yeah. Themes to it, and you can look at even The Catcher in the Rye in a separate piece, like, you know, some of those things, and we're looking at American society in different ways, whether it's a coming of age or this, and this is a this is also a criticism, a social criticism that I think as an English teacher, like, you can easily connect to today. We'll get into that. I mean, like, there's a timelessness about this, even though it is very much about the era in which it takes place. The themes transcend that. And I think that's one of the reasons it holds on. Yeah, I think you're right about the 20s, like, having solidified as this era. Also, because, like, if you think about it, as you get into it starts to pick up popularity in the 40s and then into the 50s and such. And the 30s and 40s are fraught, right? There's the Depression and the war. So the 20s is kind of the last great age of America at that point. You know, I don't like to use the word innocent, but in that sense, like, you know, and then you get into the 50s, which currently has a nostalgic sheen to it. Not the same way the 20s did. The 50s is a lot more, like the Eisenhower 50s is a lot more conservative. And then, of course, you know, the 60s. So the decades, like, you know, go. So the 20s becomes, you're right, solidified as a certain image. And Gatsby, like, embodies that. What I found interesting, really, too, is that, like, this transcends its time and is so well known and so much that other novels that have done the same thing and have been as popular still don't clear this bar or approach the bar that Gatsby had set. I think of Tom Wolfe's The Bonfire of the Vanities, which is, I've never read it. I remember the really terrible adaptation from like 89 or 90 with Tom Hanks and Bruce Willis. It was directed by, I think, Brian De Palma. But The Bonfire of the Vanities is similar, like look at these rich a-holes in New York City, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's been other plays and things like that that do offer the social criticism of the ultra rich and that society of people trying to get into the society, et cetera, et cetera. And some of them hit and some of them do not. And Gatsby just seems to endure. We kind of talked about the novel's pacing. I guess before we get into like the book itself, like we'll talk about Fitzgerald. Just knowing about is it possible to separate author from novel? Knowing about Fitzgerald's life, does that affect your reading of it?
Knowing about his life? If we were to have a spectrum, I guess, of terrible authors. Mm. I would say that he might not be as bad as Ernest Hemingway. So he's a little bit better. Oh, does it affect? I think it always colors it. I don't know how, because there are a couple of people I know that say, like, it doesn't, you know. So actually, one of my students was saying it was Drake, wasn't it? Or was it Kanye? It was one of those people saying, like, you separate the artist from the music. And I was like, at a certain point, you can't do it, young man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't know how you can completely do that separation. So I think that this one might be a bit easier, but I think it maybe it also lends some insight into what's going on and why he decided to choose these choices for his characters.
I think so too. What's interesting is that I haven't really dug deep into F. Scott Fitzgerald's life, so I know what I've picked up from, like, you know, biographical information, background information when I taught it. So I think I'm able to separate it pretty well because I didn't do a deep dive into it. And I'm not that interested in it. I mean, so, and I read it. I don't remember learning a lot about F. Scott Fitzgerald when we were reading The Great Gatsby in 11th grade. I think we're just given the book and then talked about the Jazz Age and like stuff like that. So his exploits and his marriage to Zelda, which does sound fascinating, and it's just one of those things where like we might want to look at this, didn't affect me as much. But I can see like where it is kind of like there's so much autobiographical reference in it that it is hard to separate. All right, but let's get into the book itself. We'll start with Nick, right? And he is the narrator of the book. He is the closest thing we have to like a reader insert in a sense that he's an outsider to the world of East Egg and West Egg Long Island in the same way we are. And because he has a actual relation to Daisy, he's a distant cousin, he has the ability to go between the two worlds because we early on see that like West Egg's the new money and East Egg's the old money, which is a constant thing in a lot of in our society among the rich and the wealthy, as well as a thing in other novels and movies, like, you know, the very old moneyed blue blood types versus the up and comers, you know, who just made their fortune and are flaunting it, et cetera, et cetera. Is Nick a reliable narrator?
I don't necessarily trust him, just because I think that he doesn't understand his actual feelings. I'm confused what his thoughts are about Gatsby, to be honest. I mean, I was joking about, I made my little gay Gatsby joke, but honestly, he makes two comments that are more or less, I hate everything that Gatsby stands for. And one is at the beginning of the novel and was at the end of the novel. However, he bends over backwards with like the funeral arrangements and like trying to get people to come. And so like, I don't necessarily understand what, like, I feel like feelings are conflicting. His relationship with quotes with Jordan is very like confusing. And he said he was half in love with her at the very end, but it was just like very bizarre. Plus there's some chick back west that he may or may not be engaged to, because he says that he has to like end that before it gets, I don't know, before he becomes dishonest.
Yeah.
So I think some of these events that are that don't necessarily involve him are maybe more factual. But like that what was that, chapter one or chapter two that I texted you about, that I guess he was just really drunk, and the way the novel became written seemed very drunk, and I was super confused what was going on. How could I trust if that's literally how it's being written? How could I trust him as a narrator either? So I do not. I think that there are factual moments, but there are others that I'm taking with a grain of salt, I think.
Yeah, he is kind of one of the go-to AP essay run reliable narrators, right? In when you're talking about American Lit, there are times though, you're right, where I do trust him, and that he's, and I think his curiosity about what's going on, and there, I think there is some authenticity to him, or at least some, that's like morality or compassion, that is one of the thing, I think one of the reasons behind why he is so attentive to Gatsby after Gatsby dies. Like, you know, everybody else just kind of flits away and doesn't really think about it. And he now, we'll look into like, how he felt about Gatsby, but if even if it was just a friendship, it, there's an authenticity there that I think is honorable in him. But yeah, he's complex because he does things that you like, or he kind of stands back and is just kind of the observer. And I think when you're right, when he stands back and he's kind of just the observer, he's very trustworthy in a sense as a narrator. When he's a little bit more involved or has a little bit more of a personal tie to what's going on, that's where it gets muddy. But I think that's one of the brilliant things of the writing, because that's what people are, right? I mean, he might be an unreliable narrator, but people are unreliable narrators. So he's a realistically written unreliable narrator. If you wanted an objective, completely reliable narrator, you would have written it in third person.
True.
Or something. So,
which is that one section with kind of the investigation with the car accident, because he obviously wasn't there. Did you say that his attention to morality or his dedication to morality?
Well, he has some morality, I think. Okay. I think he's a little bit. I think he has a little bit more morality than like most of the other people who are hanging around Gatsby.
Yeah.
Like, there's a little bit more there that I think helps guide him.
I guess what are your thoughts on, and this is funny because it was an Instagram reel of somebody asking someone on the street, what would you do if your best friend cheated on her boyfriend? And she said, nothing, that's my friend. But he doesn't, like, he's witnessing like all the adultery, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And I feel like the only time he partially stands up to Tom is when he almost doesn't shake his hand at the very end, because he said, you did that, right? And then he ends up shaking his hand.
Yeah, and I wonder why he's so reluctant to call out all these things that are going on. And I wonder if it's because, is he intimidated by the wealth? Is it like him knowing his place, so to speak, in the society, and that he's a guest, essentially? So that's one of the reasons he's not saying anything. There's a little bit of a naivete about him too. So like, he's not like the moral compass of the novel. He just has a slightly better one than like Tom Buchanan and Daisy and all of them and all the people that Gatsby surrounds himself with. Well, getting into Gatsby, what's your opinion of him, and did the phrase old sport get on your nerves?
It may have when I was a junior. It didn't this time, though I could read it differently depending on the person that he was speaking to, because I think he was genuine when he was saying it to Nick.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of inflected it in the way that Southerners who say bless your heart are really saying F you saying it to Tom. I personally wasn't annoyed by it. I think that was part of his shtick, to be don't call him an Oxford man. He was definitely one of the he kind of felt like a talented Mr. Ripley to me, where he saw, you know, he lived a couple different lives. He saw an opportunity and kind of took it. So I couldn't necessarily tell what was a truth and what was an untruth with him, because he had legitimate stories attached to everything. He had a pendant of some sort. Well, he had a medal from the war. He also had some sort of Oxford coin. I can't recall. And I remember whenever he was going to get caught in some sort of lie, he could talk his way out of it. And, you know, Nick was like somewhat disappointed. He's like, oh, phew, no, that's really what it is. So is he a bootlegger? I heard drugs. And so I immediately thought, oh, my gosh, he's like a drug mule. But I guess it was drug stores. So very different in the time period. He is an interesting character. I mean, he is definitely this person that you hear about, but you don't exactly know who he is. He's kind of like the Count in Dracula, just this mysterious entity. And then you finally meet him and he's somewhat aloof, but oh my gosh, he's paying you attention. And so that means, you know, I'm a special person to a certain extent. And then you realize that he did all of this for a woman that he fell in love with and he never fell out of love with her. And I think that that's both obsessive as well as very beautiful. there's definitely a lot of sympathy for him. And I think one of the greatest character moments for him, in my opinion, is that he was waiting in the bushes after that whole thing, which is nuts, all that car action. Mm-hmm. After Daisy killed Myrtle, is that her name?
Yeah.
Myrtle Wilson. Just waiting for Daisy to go to bed, you know, in case something were to happen. And I thought, you know, that right there, I think is a measure of a person, that he didn't scramble back or leave immediately. Yes, he had to hide his car, obviously, but he didn't get out of town because he knew he was going to get the blame. But he actually mm-hmm. waited to see if he could be of any comfort or support to this person that he loved. So definitely another, complex character. I feel like there are a couple people that are not very complex, but I think that Gatsby is one of them that is in this novel.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And I like that I liked your take on the unrequited love that he has for Daisy, and then what does kind of get fulfilled in a sense, but then falls apart, you know, because on the one hand, it is beautiful, but on the other hand, it's obsessive. And I like that mm-hmm. you tied those two together, because if you're doing this with teenagers, sometimes they don't see that nuance, right? So they'll be like, ew, he's a stalker, you know, or something like that. And it's like, it's a lot more nuanced than that. Mm-hmm. And he is, the way he was able to build a mystery around himself is fascinating too. And I mean, that makes him a very, very interesting character. And then when you meet him, it's not disappointing. You know, it's not like he's a total jerk or something like that. He's definitely putting on airs. And I think as you go along the novel, you can kind of see that. And even when you reread it, because, you know, we both knew going into our repeated reading of the novel that, you know, who Jay Gatz was and how he kind of built, kind of created this persona for himself. But even then, rereading it, knowing that doesn't take away from it. It actually kind of gives another layer to Gatsby when you're meeting him, and just like, this is how he's performing. I did have a question about Tom Ripley, and Gatsby's kind of this archetypal character in a sense that, like, you know, there are other characters like that. And Tom Ripley, Charles Foster Kane on some level from Citizen Kane, even though Wells based him on publisher Hearst, William Randolph Hearst. And then I jokingly put Bruce Wayne down.
Ooh.
But okay, like reading this and reading the scene of the party where he first meets Gatsby did kind of remind me of, like, the one of the most Gatsby Batman things is that scene in the first Batman movie with Michael Keaton, where Vicki Vale and Knox are in, like, a room at Wayne Manor, and they're looking at the sculpture, and he's like, he must be king of the wicker people, and they're making fun of it, and Keaton walks in, he says, it's Japanese, because I bought it in Japan. And then I thought of that, like, that's almost like a Gatsby-esque entrance. And then there's the whole thing with, like, him, you know, only like putting on the play of it all and stuff like that. And I mean, granted, some of Batman is just Bob Kane's personal fantasies. but I was just thinking of that and how, like, you have that kind of rich playboy character who has a lot more going on, but the playboy thing is the thing that they put out into the world because it's a means to an end, or there's a safety in it because of the society they're in. But no, I like him. I think you have to like this character in order to like this novel, or at least be intrigued by this character in order to like this novel. If you find Gatsby loathsome, or you don't find him interesting, then you're not going to like this story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other characters, we have Tom, we have Daisy, and we have Jordan. And I don't know, let's kind of talk about a little bit about about them. I guess we'll start with Tom and Daisy, because like Tom's the closest thing to like a villain in the story.
Mm-hmm.
He has, you know, he takes Nick with him into the city and picks up Myrtle, and it's just like they go to this hotel where basically it's this apartment he set up as a place to have the affair. So in a sense, yeah, I don't know if foil's the right term here, but like he's showing off to Nick, right? If you think about it, like he didn't have to take Nick with him to go party with Myrtle, you know, Nick has just walked into his life and Daisy's, and he's Daisy's cousin and all this stuff. So he's not competition for Daisy, but at the same time, he's peacocking for this man to show, like, you know, show this sort of weird, almost Andrew Tate, like I'm the alpha type of BS. And he does kind of embody that aspect, because he goes on this, they start talking about, you know, society and things they read and stuff, and he starts going into this whole thing about like the master race and eugenics and how, you know, they're being outbred, and it's like it's the 20s, so it's like, you know, over in Europe as you go through later in the decade, you have the rise of Nazi Germany, and we're, you know, we still see a lot of that sort of philosophy spouted, especially from the far right in this country. Why do you think, other than just making Tom look like a reprehensible human being, why do you think that Fitzgerald went so far to include all of the making this guy like a total racist, eugenicist, et cetera, et cetera?
I guess to make him the romantic opposite of, mm-hmm. of Gatsby. And I mean, for me, like I'm just completely befuddled how Daisy would stay with Tom, even from Gatsby's perspective about how he was in the war, and it seemed like he got a Dear John letter potentially, and then she married Tom while the war was going on, which is interesting. So is Tom a draft dodger? He didn't get drafted. That's kind of suspicious.
I don't. I don't know. I don't know how old he is compared to her. There's, you know, it's not beyond the realm of reason to say that a very, very rich person was able to get out of active duty, because it's been done time and again.
Yeah, that's very true.
So,
the only positive things that we find are from Tom's perspective, but Daisy's reaction tells us that they're probably true, where he's pleading with her. It's that whole, that weird scene. I can't even imagine being Nick or Jordan in that room when that mm-hmm. whole thing is going on. I'm like, tell him you don't love him. Where Tom is saying, you remember when we ... And it was clearly like, he carried her. I think she was barefoot or something. It was muddy. I don't remember, but it seems like sweet, and she could not deny that she did actually love Tom. So I think having a polar opposite to Gatsby, who seems like very romantic lead, swashbuckler kind of thing, and then this other guy who just seems just terrible in every aspect. The other thing is, you know, someone recently told me that I don't agree with it, to be honest. But I'll just at least put it out there that you can overlook, what would the word be? I don't know, traits that you don't care for, basically, if they're good in the sack. And I don't actually agree with this, because I'm just thinking about this Tom here is like, oh yeah, you can overlook that he's a eugenicist because he's real good in the sack. But I just wonder if money has to do with it. However, Daisy seems to have lived with money as well, because I think if he were super rich, they can be like, well, here's an example of, even though this is a terrible person, if you're rich, you can kind of get over those things. Or if you're marrying rich, you can get over those bad things. But she was coming from money too. So I don't know exactly beyond the polar opposite. But it makes it to have him like not necessarily redeemed, but to have Fitzgerald give him positive qualities to a certain extent, at least through Daisy, is just a bit bizarre. Like, he wasn't fully ready to pull that trigger. But even at the end, when he basically led George Wilson, was that his name, George?
Yeah.
To Gatsby, like, okay, so any good favor was undone by that anyways. So I don't know, Tom.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It is like he's almost trying to layer this character as well by showing that there were those good moments that Daisy is remembering. I can see the money thing was the thing where I was like, you know, I can make that compromise. And it's not that she was in it for the money. It's just that particular strata of society marries within one another. So the compromises you make in order to make sure that you're marrying correctly, so to speak, I think is part of it as well. So it's maybe just a social class thing too. And there are certain things you can overlook or sweep under the rug or brush aside because this was the quote unquote right person to marry as others perceived it, as opposed to the guy you were actually in love with who was not, you know, who was too poor, et cetera, et cetera. Did she love him? You know, I think she did. Daisy is she's a bit flighty in the sense I don't think she's manipulating either Gatsby or Tom. I think she honestly just doesn't know what to do in a lot of the scenarios that she's in there, and she gets caught up with it, and maybe she never actually came to terms with some of the emotions that she had for Jay, and then he comes around and it's all of a sudden like, you know, everything is very, very confusing. And this is maybe one of the first really serious things she's had to consider, because she's very immature. They have a daughter who she just kind of like blows off. You know, the idea that like the daughter is just kind of this burden that she's got to bear, like, you know, the maid takes care of her or whatever because she's too young and et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a frivolousness to her that makes you wonder what Jay saw in her before. Was she different when she was younger? And she's changed by being with Tom. I mean, it's just really interesting to look at her as a character and see like somebody who's not the most deep person. And you're wondering, like, she's obviously beautiful, but you're also wondering, like, what did Gatsby see in her? I don't know. What was your take on Daisy?
Yeah. You know, I like strong female characters. I hope to have them. She's not necessarily the best example of a strong female character. I think she's able to, I guess, survive Tom, but she doesn't necessarily push back against him, which is unfortunate. I don't know if he abuses her. That is unclear, but I guess I wouldn't put it past him that he has hit her in the past. We know, I mean, sexual freedom, I think in the 20s. So it seems, you know, pretty clear that she was probably, maybe hooking up with a lot of the officers and cadets that were coming her way. I don't have my book in front of me because Gatsby actually says, I mean, because he was going out with a bunch of people that I think he would, or women he would consider floozies. But he did not see Daisy as one of them. I felt like for him, she was a real, I don't know, a real girl, whatever that meant for him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she's a manic pixie dream girl of the 20s.
That's a good point.
Just something that is unquantifiable that he, or unqualifiable, that he really fell for and was taken with. She's no fool, I don't think, because I think she knows absolutely what's up with Tom. I don't know that he knows, or she knows that it's, well, actually, I do want to talk about this. So as a sidebar,
mm-hmm.
does she know that it's Myrtle? Does she drive? So the presentation by Gatsby is that she was going to avoid Myrtle running into the road, and that, but it would have hit something else. And so she turned, but from everyone else's perspective, it looked like the car got close to Myrtle purposely. And I wondered if, obviously, Myrtle was going to that car because she had seen Tom in that car before. So she was probably going to try to talk to him. But I do wonder if Daisy knew on some level that that was the woman, and that this was maybe not wholly unintentional vehicular manslaughter. Because I think she knew that Tom was having an affair, but I don't know. Did she know? Who he was having an affair with. And I agree with you that I think she does love Tom in whatever way love manifests, because of how upset she gets in that meeting, and that she can't, even though she says, I only loved you, Gatsby. And then she's like, I can't lie. I actually, you know, I love you both. I love Tom. And I think because she's so broken down there and raw, that I think she is telling a truth.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. Yeah, I don't know if she knew it was Myrtle either. But I know she was not dumb enough to think that he was being faithful to her.
Mm-hmm.
The thing we're talking about, like, this is in chapter, toward the end of chapter, it was middle of chapter 8, when Nick is, just essentially recapping everything he found out about Gatsby's life after Gatsby's death. And Daisy and him are exchanging letters during the war, and, you know, they break up, et cetera, et cetera. She says, and he says, through this twilight universe, Daisy began to move again with the season. Suddenly she was again keeping half a dozen dates a day with half a dozen men, and drowsing asleep at dawn with the beads and chiffon of an evening dress tangled among dying orchids on the floor beside her bed. And all the time, something within her was crying for a decision. She wanted her life shaped now, immediately, and the decision, must be made by some force of love, of money, of unquestionable practicality that was close at hand. The force took shape in the middle of the spring with the arrival of Tom Buchanan. So it is interesting to see, like, you know, how he was at the right place at the right time. And, but she did, yeah, she did on some level love, she did love him. And I think you're right, where it's like, you know, she is having such a crisis of conscience about the two of them. And she's being, and the two of them are fighting over her, essentially, and forcing her to choose, which she doesn't necessarily want to do. And she ends up having, you know, obviously Gatsby gets killed, but I don't get the feeling that she would have ever run away with him.
With or without her baby?
Yeah. Like, I just don't get the, I don't get the feeling that Gatsby was, this was, this novel was ever going to end differently, that Gatsby was never going to get the girl, because her position and who she is and the stability she has in the marriage with Tom and that part of society probably still outweighs anything that Jay Gatsby can give her and has done. Because there's like, yeah sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I also don't think she's brave enough.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I think that also shows, like, the East Egg, West Egg differences, where people in the old money view the new money as upstarts, and Gatsby came by his fortune in less than in kind of unscrupulous ways, right? Dealing with kind of shady businessmen and things like that, and bootlegging. So he is as ostentatious as he can be, and as much as he can flaunt wealth or money, he's never going to have true access and acceptance in the other world. But some would want, although he just wants Daisy, which is the whole light of the green dock on the end of the green dock symbol and such. Because it is one of the classic symbols in American literature, right? The end of the green dock, and he's looking out at it. Do you interpret it as his longing for Daisy? Is there something deeper there?
I think certainly longing and also reaching towards that that great American dream that he feels like he had, like, you know, he's got the status, he's got the money, he's got the parties. He doesn't have the girl, you know, what else is there? But it's still like unattainable because I think he is never going to necessarily reach it. And I mean, even if he does have those parties, he doesn't have an actual friend. It's just so sad that the lack of funeral.
Yeah.
Even though that one man was spouting some philosophy about, you know, we show up when they're alive, not when they're dead. I'm like, okay.
The other thing, well, the emptiness he feels too is very palpable in his character, even in the happy moments where he's enthusiastic about this friendship with Nick. You can tell that he's trying to fill something inside of him that Daisy, you know, that maybe Daisy can do that for him or whatever it is. But he's a very sad character, despite his coolness. One last character where we'll get into the relationship that she has in the book with our narrator. You want strong women. I actually like the character of Jordan quite a bit. She is the foil for Daisy, where she is strong-willed and independent. And as much of an observer as Nick is to things. What did you think of her? What about the relationship between the two of them, Nick and Jordan?
Yeah, to be honest, I think I'd like you to take this a bit, because Jordan was someone who actually constantly confused me. I really couldn't tell what she was saying. Not in the literal, like I'm reading.
Yeah.
I see, but just like what is her meaning behind it? Even at the very end when she said that she was treated poorly by Nick, I'm like, Nick wanted to leave that place. Why were you treated poorly? And this, like, are they in some sort of quasi romance or not? So I don't understand Jordan's character. So I would like you to begin, and then I'll see if anything sparks.
The Wikipedia summary of the book, which I was reading through, used the word insolent to describe her. So I guess it's kind of like, and she's a bit of a brat.
Yeah.
It's, and you know, and a liar. I like the character because she is not naive and she's a bit cynical in that way, but she's also really selfish and self-serving. There's kind of a what's in it for me aspect to her that I think just makes her interesting and that such. The relationship with Nick is like this casual, I don't know how either of them look. He kind of is falling for her. Does she even like him? Is it just a casual thing for her because it's just something to keep occupied, and when she's not, she doesn't need him anymore? It's like, you know, whatever. She's a little bit confusing, but I think that's what makes her interesting. More, to be honest, than Daisy, who is, again, just kind of, she is treated like an object herself, but Jordan is not. And I think I don't think Fitzgerald's making any criticism of independent women or anything like that. I think he's just he is giving us a character opposite of Daisy, also maybe throwing a little bit at the whole flapper jazz aspect of it because of that, you know, because of what it represented. I'm not entirely sure myself.
Yeah, and I think rich people being irresponsible and not necessarily caring. And, you know, if that's the theme, because of course you'll read, you know, that quote at the end, then this is, I think it's just like another aspect. She lied and cheated in sports. I don't know how, maybe she paid off the caddy because the caddy reported her and then withdrew, or what's it called when they take back their rescind statement. Yeah. And how bad she was driving, which everyone drives terribly. And you, like, if you've not even read this before, you know that something, there's going to be some incident with a car because of all the bad driving. And her saying, like, well, you know, it takes two bad drivers to, you know, make some sort of issue. So as long as everyone else is fine, you know, I can do what I want, which was really interesting. So I think you're right that she's pretty selfish and conceited in that way. I don't know that Nick, even though he says he's half in love with her, it might be more of a, like, maybe enamored of her, you know, like her, I don't know, her
aspects. No, I think that's a really good way to phrase it.
Yeah. I will say that I think her best, the ending, I think, and her line at the end where she recalls that conversation about the cars, I feel like is her best line, where, you know, she asks Nick, do you remember what you said about them? And that it, whatever, it takes two bad drivers to make some sort of wreck. And then she said, we were the bad drivers. And I was like, yeah, that was a good way to, you know, put the, you know, have this metaphor work for what was going on. Like, you both kind of, I mean, it was, could have been more damaging, because I feel like Daisy and Gatsby are kind of the two bad drivers, but yeah, Nick and Jordan really didn't do much for each other either.
Yeah, you're right. I'm looking for that line, but I can't remember exactly. Oh, here we go. This is where they break up and they run into each other. It's right, but like he runs into Jordan, then he runs into Tom, and then he ends the novel at Gatsby's estate. And so this is like, the novel ends on page one. My copy of the novel ends on page 180. This is page 177. So it's like right toward the end. She says, like, you did throw me over. You threw me over on the telephone. I don't give a damn about you now, but it is a new experience for me. And I felt a little dizzy for a while. So I guess she's not used to guys breaking up with her.
Yeah, might be.
So we shook hands and she says, oh, and do you remember a conversation we had once about driving a car? And he says, why not exactly? You said a bad driver was only safe until she met another bad driver. Well, I met another bad driver, didn't I?
Yeah.
I mean, it was careless of me to make such a wrong guess. I thought you were rather an honest, straightforward person. I thought that was your secret pride. I'm 30, I said. This is Nick. I'm 5 years too old to lie to myself and call it honor. She didn't answer, angry and half in love with her. I'm tremendously sorry. I turned away.
I wonder what she thinks he's lying about.
I wonder if she's being defensive because he broke up with her. Like, you know, it's just to get back at him. And breaking she's being, up.
They're not
you know,
even together. This, yeah. That's but ridiculous. It's just like
she, I think she's been rejected and she's not used to losing in that sense. Right. So maybe that's part of it. Kind of a scorned lover, even though they kind of part on this weird amicable type of terms. It's really, really interesting that it's almost like they come to an agreement at the end, which is strange in a way, because you don't necessarily expect that. Getting into, we'll do our, we've talked a little bit about the wealthy and the commentary of high society, etc. I think we'll save that toward the end of the discussion because it is such a huge thing. We've talked a little bit about the American dream. Let's get into queer interpretations of the because there have been a number of people who have read Nick as gay, perhaps Gatsby, like shipping Gatsby and Nick. There's a scene in chapter 2 or 3 where at the party and he's gotten hammered and he wakes up in his underwear in a bed with somebody named Mr. McKee. Is that solid proof of his homosexuality? Is he bisexual? I mean, like, what? I'm going to defer to you first. What is your interpretation of this? Is there a queerness to Nick or Gatsby that it's like a subtext that Fitzgerald's writing?
Yeah, so again, I just want to preface this by saying I would not have noticed this in high school.
Well, me neither.
Okay, and because I've been doing the Iliad for several months, there's lots of queerness on my mind.
Man, love and wrestling.
And we're currently recording in June, which is Pride Month. But honestly, like, when you read that scene, it's so weird. And it's like a dot, dot, dot. And then, like, why is this man in his underwear? And why is Nick standing by his bed? Like, it's very, I don't know how you can not interpret that? I mean, I sent it to Tom and said, like, hey, is it just me? Tom said it wasn't. And again, I mean, you know, if we're to connect this with the Iliad, which is the goal of this show, of course, is to connect it to other literature. it's almost seen, I mean, they're not super close, but it is very much like an Achilles Patroclus business, because again, you know, this man goes out of his way to talk to people that he may have mentioned or talked to at a party, but had no connection to whatsoever. Might have gotten killed as well, because I'm sure the mob was involved, because I think Chicago was in there. Mm-hmm. And is trying to get them to come to the funeral. I think I could use the word enamored again with Gatsby. I think Gatsby has an aura maybe about him. I don't know. I was thinking, yeah, is Nick gay? I feel like Nick might be bi, because I do think that he genuinely likes the company of women. I don't know. It's never been sussed out. I guess it wasn't important, though. I felt maybe if the detail was there, then it was supposed to be important. This girl, this woman in the West that what is that called? The blanks were put in the bands. The bands were put in the newspaper over there. And then so everyone thought that he was engaged. And also he mentioned like he needed to cut that off. And then of course, Jordan. So I feel like he does have an attraction to men and women. And yeah, I think because he attaches himself to Gatsby, even though he quote unquote hates everything that, you know, Gatsby stands for. Yeah. So I do think that. I wonder what English teachers do with this. They actually teach it at my current school. I should email the English teacher and ask if she sees a gay subtext in it. But yeah, I mean, that's my reading, I think, is that he's bi. Otherwise, why put that in there? And like I'm saying, I think there is more sexual freedom in the 20s.
Yeah.
So perhaps we wouldn't bat as much of an eye at it. And you know, we've got the spectacle man. What's his name? Eckelberg.
Yeah,
which is, you know, a representation of God, which is like very in your face at one point when George is holding Myrtle up in the window. But you know, I think everyone is they've got something that they might be holding on to that might be considered quote unquote immoral, and that might be Nick's in this representation.
Yeah, Fitzgerald isn't exactly subtle with the symbolism, is he? No, I agree with you. That's where I was kind of looking at it, where I saw that scene, and then I'm looking at the way he is enamored of Gatsby, but he's also, I think his feelings for Jordan are genuine. I don't think he's trying to fake his way through it in order to stay, you know, in the closet. So I think I would, if I had to put a label on it, I would also say he's bisexual. Gatsby, I'm not sure of. I could see where you think, where somebody might think that Gatsby's also looking for a lover, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't know. I think he genuinely wants a friend, because he's a lonely person. Yeah. He's so enamored of Daisy anyway. He's so after Daisy anyway, that pairing him with Nick would never work. You know, like that was never going to be a thing, an option, because
he's
of
just
his
an old sport.
Yeah, it's just an old sport.
But he's friend zoned.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe if this was written in a later decade where there was more acceptance of LGBTQ queer people, Fitzgerald might have walked across that line. Mm. It's almost like he's walking right up to the line and not going across it to show with confirmation that Nick enjoys the company of men as much as he enjoys the company of women. I wonder if that's just a side effect of the time in which he's writing, because there was more sexual liberation in the 20s, but it was still a very conservative society compared to, say, now, where people can be openly gay and trans and non-binary, sexual, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, bi. So I think that he was maybe towing the line a little bit by having that portrayal. But yeah, because you had texted me, like, you know, what's going on with Mr. McKee? And I flipped back to it and I looked at him, like, and I think my response was like, I think he's implying that he was sleeping with him.
Yeah.
Because that's what I got out of it. I was like, did they, you know, did they hook up? You know?
Yeah.
I guess the non-queer interpretation was that he just simply passed out because he blacked out.
Yeah.
So.
And we know that Mr. McKee was the one who took photographs, wasn't he? Portraits and things. Yeah. So I could imagine some erotic portraits, and then one thing led to another. But well, I mean, otherwise, why include that scene?
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you.
That would be my question.
Yeah.
I
think it adds another layer to it too.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could think of, like, what would the other characters think in terms of sexuality and such? Would Jordan be a good candidate for somebody who was? Although I think that is stereotyping the independent woman also being a lesbian or something like that. How deep does this run through the novel? I think is a really interesting avenue to explore, even in a high school class. Although you have to have the maturity among the students to do it. And high school boys aren't always the most mature when it comes to to queerness. So, tread carefully.
Indeed.
Yeah. So there's other characters in there. And we're talking about, you know, we've talked about the racism in there. We've also talked about queerness. There's Gatsby's main business partner or business associate is a guy named Wolfsheim, who's a German German Jew. And he's been criticized. Fitzgerald was criticized even during his lifetime for writing this character as an anti-Semitic stereotype, because he's a crooked banker. His features are described in that sort of way. Reportedly, Fitzgerald was actually upset over these accusations. He said he simply created a character. Critics point out that this description and portrayal was just a trope of the time. So is it an anti-Semitic portrayal? Is it being read too much into in terms of the character?
I don't know. I did not read that character that closely, so I don't know that I can respond. So I shall pass to you.
I didn't either. And I saw that. Because I was like, you know, because I didn't think. The funny thing is I missed the description of him, and I had to go back and read it. I was like, oh, yeah. Because I was just thinking German, right? Wolfsheim and stuff like that. And we're not that. I mean, Fitzgerald had no idea what was going to happen in Nazi Germany. Fitzgerald had no concept of what Nazi Germany was going to be, because it was 1922.
Mm-hmm.
Berlin was cosmopolitan back in the 20s. I mean, they were suffering from the Great Depression, but before you get the rise of the Nazis, it was a fairly cosmopolitan city. He may have visited there. Because he was in Europe, but I didn't get that from this, although I can see where it does seem to come off as an anti-Semitic trope of the Jewish crooked Jewish banker, which it's like, okay, yeah, I can see where, even if you didn't intend to do that with that character, you did, because maybe it was the common portrayal of the day or something, which is, so I don't want to give it a pass, but I don't think it's you dismiss the novel based on it.
Yeah. I guess I was more focused on allies or whatever. It was like a throwaway character anyways, but I didn't really think about Wolf and Sean until he does come back again at the very end.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about the setting.
Okay.
So it is a great American novel. We discussed this. It's also one of the quintessential New York novels.
Oh.
It goes from Manhattan to Queens to out to Long Island, North Shore. That is still the rich, rich part of the North Shore. It's like really Tony and such. I'm from the South Shore of Long Island. I'm not from the, and I'm like middle of the South Shore of Long Island. So I'm not even out in the Hamptons.
What's the difference between North Shore, South Shore, and Jersey Shore?
The North Shore, well, the Jersey Shore is in New Jersey.
Okay. Culturally, are they, would you say they're absolutely different as well?
The North Shore is a lot more WASPy.
Oh, I see.
In Long Island, and then the South Shore is a little more for years was working class. Like one of the sayings was that you either marry or you date a rich girl from the North Shore and a nice or a nice girl from the South Shore, and the Jersey Shore is just trash.
I see.
But yeah, so and they are literally shore the north and south of the island too, because the North Shore is on the Long Island Sound and the South Shore is on the Great South Bay. So he uses a very real like it is a real place. He's making real references. He puts them in the Plaza Hotel. The Valley of Ashes was an actual thing, the offshoot of all of this industry that didn't get cleaned up until the following decade when Robert Moses just tore through it to create the World's Fair site in Flushing Meadows. And eventually, like I said, it's where LaGuardia Airport and Citi Field and the tennis center are. So now it's actually parkland and things like that. There's New York, and this is as much of a character. I see New York as much of a character in this novel as I see the characters themselves, kind of in the way that The Catcher in the Rye is a New York novel, and that New York is its own character. Did you get that from this?
I guess I think more about the eggs. And then they take their little day trips to New York. I suppose so. I mean, if we're counting the eggs as part of New York and you're thinking New York proper, yeah, then I would say yes, because of course where you are determines who you are. And you can get a sense of, like, I can very vividly picture in my head when we're talking about West Egg and East Egg, what that looks like and everything. So, yes, I would say so.
Yeah, me too. The question I had was, could you do this in another city? I suppose you could. I think the tone would be different if you, because if you did this like in the, you could do this in the South, in a sense, because you have a lot of old money in the South, right? And you could do old money versus new money, but the tone of the novel would be completely different. It would, and you could do this. Or you could set this in modern day and you're out in, I don't know, Sonoma Valley or something. Or you're just like, we can see this clash of classes, the guy trying to get his way in, et cetera, in a different, a lot of different settings. I think the use of the setting is really important, though, and making the setting a character is really important. So, and the funny thing is that like Long Island is still like that. So, or that part of Long Island is still like that. So it is contemporary as much as it is historical in that way. And I do love the New York aspects of it. I mean, granted, I'm biased. I grew up on Long Island, so this is one of those novels that rings a bell because I'm like, oh, I've been out there. So I know where Great Neck and Manhasset are, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, so let's talk about the wealthy, the rich. We've been talking about that high society. So actually, I'm going to go to the quote. Okay, so like one of my favorite quotes is he runs into Tom.
Oh, Tom.
He's talking to Tom, et cetera, et cetera, and then right before he shakes hands with him, he says, "I couldn't figure." This is page 179, so it's the second to last page of the book. "I couldn't forgive him or like him, but I saw that what he had done was to him entirely justified." I believe he's talking about with Gatsby and George, etc. "It was all very careless and confused." And then this is the line that I actually love this commentary here. "They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together and let other people clean up the mess that they had made." What do you think of that in terms of like, is that Fitzgerald's voice more than Nick's? I mean, like, is that him kind of putting a
Oh.
button on it at the end, his concluding statement? Yeah, what do you think of that commentary and
I
overall
think
what
that's
Fitzgerald's in?
certainly definitely the moral of the story. I think it's also a timeless and relevant moral. And yeah. I guess that's all I have to say about it. I mean, yeah, I think that it's both Nick as well as potentially Fitzgerald too. Though I feel like Fitzgerald did have his time. amongst the rich. So I guess depending, I mean, if he wasn't having a good time of it, then this could be his bitter woes coming out. But I think that this is true of the reality of middle class and the poor versus the rich, and how the rich often just do what they want and don't really care at the ramifications or the collateral damage.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's also that whole idea of that, like, that much wealth allows you to just either rebound or just move on without that much damage to yourself. You know, somebody who's of a lower class and had something really bad like this happen to them, it's ruining their life.
Yeah.
You know, and the rich, they can walk away from it, you know, fairly unscathed. You know, whether it be a CEO getting a golden parachute after completely bankrupting the company, you know, company or something like that, you know, they get a little bit of damage, but then they're back several years later with something else or something like this. You know, you're covering up somebody's death, or you are really just using these people because you think you are above them. And yeah, so and he certainly felt that way about Myrtle and George. He was stringing George along with selling the car. There's this whole repeated thing. I think it was like Gatsby's car, even. He just kept saying, I'll sell you the car. I'll sell you the car. And he was just kind of stringing him along, maybe to kind of keep things in the sphere so that he could be with Myrtle, who he was also stringing along, etc. And yeah, they're just playthings. And there's a cynicism in that line that I think just like is so good because it's so today too. We see this nowadays so much and such, whether or not it be our celebrity culture or the culture of the rich, et cetera, in places like Manhattan, like, because like Tom and Daisy just basically, they go off somewhere. He doesn't say where they went. They just kind of take a convalescence somewhere else, and it's like, okay, we're going back into our world, and all the rest of us are left cleaning up all the mess that they made, and they can just kind of retreat back into their being wealthy. And I think that's still the case today.
What happened to the dog?
I don't know.
I never really understood, because George finds a leash and Tom goes up to the apartment and finds something of the dog. So I just wondered where that dog was. Maybe with her sister, Catherine.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe he ran away.
Yeah. So, do you think Daisy, was she beat up about it? I mean, it seemed like it, because she was like locked in her room.
About the
vehicular manslaughter?
I think so. But I think once again, her ability, her being so part of that world, and her ability to just kind of turn around and walk away from it is what will, you know, kind of keep her going and help her, is the thing she'll use to cope or heal. But I think she is torn up about it at first. But I don't think, you know, it'll just kind of fade, you know? I don't gather that people like that recognize trauma.
No, plus they're escaping. They're leaving that area. Yeah. So
yeah.
Out of sight, out of mind.
That's it. That's how you deal with it. You escape. All right. A couple more questions. Second to last one. The last few sentences of the book. So I'm going to read the last couple of paragraphs here. He's standing on the shore. He's standing on the dock looking out, et cetera, et cetera. He said, "And as the moon rose higher, the inessential houses began to melt away, until gradually I became aware of the old island here that flowered once for Dutch sailors' eyes, a fresh green breast of the new world. Its vanished trees, the trees that had made way for Gatsby's house, had once pandered in whispers to the last and greatest of all human dreams. For a transitory, enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder. And as I sat there brooding on the old unknown world, I thought of Gatsby's wonder when he first picked out the green light at the end of Daisy's dock. He had come a long way to this blue lawn. and his dreams must have seemed so close that he could hardly fail to grasp it. He did not know that it was already behind him. Somewhere back in that vast obscurity beyond the city, where the dark fields of the Republic rolled on under the night. Gatsby believed in the green light, the orgiastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther. And one fine morning, so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. So, like, what do you get from that's the very ending of the book. What do you get from that?
I don't know. Does he think that Gatsby actually attained what he was searching for? And hopes that he can rest peacefully, but maybe he thought that Gatsby in his mind can't reach rest peacefully. I don't know. I mean, even with Nick himself, he's not living the American dream. I don't even know how he is able to live in the town that he does, right next to that mansion, on the salary, which doesn't seem to be a lot of money.
Apparently it's like a bungalow or something that it's renting.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. And he has a Finn, which I was trying to figure out what that was, and thought, is that a butler? A Finn? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, perhaps he's learned the lesson of Gatsby and what, you know, the struggles that he had gone through.
Yeah, there's like a futility about this a little bit too, because he said he came a long way to this blue lawn. His dream must have seemed so close that he could hardly feel the grasp, but he did not know that it was already behind him. Like, you'll get so close to it, yet you will never attain. Like, there'll always be something missing. There'll always be an emptiness. And I don't know, like, we're always trying for it and we're not getting it. Or, you know, there's like, maybe this is the sort of American dream aspect of it, that there's a futility to it, that we're never, that you're never going to get it because you're searching for something that doesn't really exist. You know, it's like the orgiastic future that you're seen before. It's like, it's an ideal that you cannot possibly attain. And we literally kill ourselves trying to do it in some cases. And it's a sad ending. It's a poignant one, but it's very melancholy in my mind without being melodramatic. You know, it's very contemplative. I think Nick's earned enough capital in our minds in terms of us trusting him as a narrator, despite our knowing he's not the most reliable person to make that commentary, because he's the only one left. At that point, everybody else has either died or gone their ways. And he's just kind of standing there. He's going to leave too, right? So it's just, he's turning out the green light. He's turning out the light, so to speak. So, all right. Anything else before I ask that last question?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I guess here we go. Is this required reading?
I believe that it is. I think that it has withstood the test of time for a good reason. And I think that it should still be, I think everyone should read it. And I mean, when I said that I was reading this, and then I'd say, like, for the first time, people would, because they weren't letting me finish, people would give me shocked looks because they thought I was going to say for the first time. I was like, no. And I did say 10 years, but it's really just 20 years. And yeah, I think there's a reason, a good reason why it's on the curriculum. Do you think that this could be a potential banned book in this administration's America due to the quote unquote immorality?
I could see that. I could see it's, and its criticism of the wealthy, but no, the immorality of the people, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. No, I also agree with you. This is definitely required reading. It's interesting to see, like, when you scroll TikTok and you come across, you know, Lit Talk or Book Talk or whatever, and some people decry this novel because you're just like, this is boring and stuff like that. And it's Or some people, I've actually seen people say something to the extent of like, why do we have to read this? It's so old. And it's just like, the whole point of this, or why do I care about rich people? Blah, blah, blah. It was like some really shallow interpretation that comes from like a petulant kid. And it's like one huge, it's like you're missing one huge point of the novel, which is, look at these a-holes. Mm. Like, these people are a-holes. And he's pointing that out at the end. And I think this is, you know, in a culture that is enamored with celebrity and is enamored. Like, you talk to kids when they're like, what do you want to be when you grow up? That type of thing. And you hear, you do, the nature of the occupation changes over time. It's been actor, actress, celebrity, pro athlete, influencer, et cetera, but it's all about making the big coin. And because that's the culture that we have, and you know, you're a teenager, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that putting Gatsby in front of them and really going through this examination of what money does to people, mm-hmm. and how shallow and hollow it is really, really important. So maybe they'll ban it for being anti-capitalist. I don't know. but no, I think it's it's almost like a moral lesson too. And I think that the story of these people makes it really good. And it's beautifully written. Mm-hmm. So beautifully written that I think you just have to read it for that too. All right. Well, we don't have any feedback at the moment. So, yeah. So send us your feedback on, I know Robert saw that we dropped episode 103, which is Never Let Me Go. And he said he hadn't read the book, but he was looking forward to listening to the episode. So, but we do have another book for another month. So Stella, what are we reading for next month?
Yeah. So we're going to do some mythology. But lighter mythology. So, you know, fear not that I've chosen another epic. We're going to read Percy Jackson and the Olympians, Book One, The Lightning Thief by Rick Riordan.
Okay, cool. And come back for that. Until then, as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And if a friend of yours is distressed emotionally and says that they believe it'd be a good idea for them to drive because they'll be able to like calm down in that way, don't let them. Don't let them.
No. No. Drive safe. Good night.
Goodbye.
Every morning, every evening, don't we have fun? Twins and pairs, dear, pumpkin pairs, dear.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Required Reading with Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.